John chapter 2, verses 1 to 11. On the third day, there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus also was invited to the wedding with his disciples. When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now there were 6 stone water jars there for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." And they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the feast." So they took it. When the master of the feast tasted the water, now become wine, and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves the good wine first, and when people have drunk freely, then the poor wine. But you have kept the good wine until now." This, the first of his signs, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee, and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him.
Thank you very much, Brian, and can I add my welcome to Brian's? It's great to have you here with us, especially if this is your first time coming along here to the Moorgate Talks. As Brian said earlier, we do this once a year. We look at a series where we try to answer some of the big questions of life. And today's question is this: is God irrelevant? It was a sunny day in the countryside, and my brother and I got talking, and we were walking along, and we started talking about why it is that his friends aren't interested in Christianity, aren't interested in Jesus. Now, it helps to know that my brother is a base jumper, so he likes jumping off mountains and things like that with a parachute. And many of his friends think that Christianity is boring and irrelevant. Maybe they think it doesn't have the same adrenaline rush as jumping off the north face of the Eiger with a parachute. But as far as they're concerned, they are enjoying life. They have life, real life, as far as they're concerned, right now. And so they don't think they need anything else. They don't think they need Jesus. They don't think they need God. And I guess that's true for many people. Maybe it's true for us. Maybe that's a question you have. And it certainly fits our culture. We live in an age of suspicion and the self. Let me explain what I mean by that. We live in an age of suspicion, don't we? We're suspicious of truth claims, of people who claim that they know. Truth, it seems to many people, is a way of just grabbing power and abusing. We're suspicious of politicians and bankers and even vicars. We're suspicious of their spin. Maybe the big Oscars winner spotlight reflects a bit of that. And we're suspicious of Christianity as well. But there is one truth, though, that we value in the age of the self. We want to be true to ourselves. Now, you can understand that. We want to be free, don't we? All of us. We want to be free to be ourselves. As long as, of course, we don't hurt other people. But we want to be free. As the band Oasis sang, "I'm free to be whatever I choose, and I'll sing the blues if I want." We want to be free, free to experience all that life has to offer. And so you come across those books, don't you, in Waterstones on the shelf that say 500 places to visit before you die, or 500 things to eat, or 500 films to see, all those lists that are constantly on Facebook and other social media. Things to do before you die. And for many of us, life is good, isn't it? And so we start thinking, what else do I need? Isn't God irrelevant in that context? I've got real life now. Well, maybe my brother's friends are right, or so it seems. Maybe God is irrelevant. And it seems that the statistics back that up. Statistics released only last month, well, actually in January, saying that the Church of England attendance figures have dipped below 1 million. And so we think, well, maybe religion is just one long, dull church service where you sit around and have to be good or pretend that you are. Maybe God in that context is just irrelevant to my life. Well, if you've ever thought like that, or you know someone who does, I think this passage has a surprising answer for us. Because I think it shows us that actually we are missing out on real life. Because real life with the real Jesus is better than we ever imagined. And our guide, the one who's going to show us that, the one who's going to do the introductions, is a man called John, one of Jesus' two or three best mates. And what he's done is write up Jesus' life as a biography. But better than Steve Jobs' biography, he is with him and has spent 3 years with him. It's not like Walter Isaacson, who just spent a few hours doing a few interviews with him. Here, John was there and he saw it all and heard it all firsthand. And the big point of this biography that he has written up is this, and I'm reading here from a verse right at the end of John's Gospel. You don't need to look it up. Let me read it out for us. This is what it says in John chapter 20. Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. Do you see what that quote is saying? He wants us to have life, real life. And that comes through knowing the real Jesus. First of all then, real life, real life. We get this story that was read out for us. And John calls it a sign in verse 11. A pointer, if you like, to real life. Signs, they point to things, don't they? Well, this is a pointer to real life, to the future. It's the big day. The big day has arrived. And the couple get married. And everything goes to plan. No one fluffs their lines. The best man doesn't lose the ring. The sun is shining. Maybe it's picture perfect. Everything is perfect. And then the reception happens. And suddenly things go wrong. They run out of wine. They've got nothing left to drink. It's very embarrassing. You can imagine the looks from the bride to the groom. This was his job. She did all the rest of the planning and organising. He's messed up the one thing, it seems, that he had to do. And there's no time to run down to Majestic or Tesco's to top up. It's a nightmare. And there is Jesus in the middle of all of this. And he is with his disciples and he is a guest. So verse 3, his mother goes up to him and tells him what's happened. And so he instructs the servants. And verse 7 shows us they fill up with water, these big jars. That's all they do. They do what they're told. Maybe they think it's a bit weird to do that. But they do it. They know it's only water. They fill them up. And Jesus says, take some of it to the MC. And he tastes it. And he doesn't know where it's come from. So there's no collusion here. And amazingly, it has turned into wine. Well, doesn't that all seem like a nice little neat party trick? The kind of thing that maybe David Blaine or Dynamo or someone like that could do. Is that what's going on? Well, I think not. And the first reason is because of the scale of this sign. First of all, there's the quality. Verse 10 tells us it's the best wine that there is. Usually, the way it used to work at weddings is that you serve a bit of the best wine. And then when all of that is gone, and when people can't taste the difference anymore, you bring out the plonk. But this is your £800 vintage Bordeaux. This is the best wine there is. This is the kind of stuff you save for a good occasion, a special occasion. You can imagine the wine critics as they swill it round in the glass and they smell it. And they say, and they breathe it in, a fine nose, flavours, subtle flavours. And then they taste it, and it's even better than it smells. Complex flavours. A vintage year. In fact, the best wine that I've ever tried. You can almost smell it. No, this is no magic trick. And then there's not just the quality, there's the quantity as well. 6 massive jars or vats full to the brim. Each of them, verse 6 says, holds 20 to 30 gallons. We're talking 800 bottles of vintage Bordeaux, 65 cases of the stuff. We need to ask some of you over here or maybe over here to move so we could get it all in. It's a huge quantity, more than enough for a wedding. This is amazing. This isn't a magic trick. But that's not all. Because the main reason this isn't a magic trick is because John calls it a sign in verse 11. You see, it points to something. And these people there, they are Jews, and they know their Old Testaments, and they know what was promised in the Old Testament by Isaiah, by the prophet Isaiah, as he promised a feast, a great feast of wine and food. And it is God who is doing the catering. Let me read it out for us, those few verses that are printed there on your sheets. You might want to follow it as I read it out. On this mountain, the Lord of hosts will make for all peoples a feast of rich food, a feast of well-aged wine, of rich food, full of marrow, of aged wine, well-refined. And he will swallow up on this mountain the covering that is cast over all peoples, the veil that is spread over all nations. He will swallow up death forever. And the Lord God will wipe away tears from all faces. And the reproach of his people he will take away from the earth. For the Lord God has spoken. Do you see what it's saying? It's a feast of well-aged wine. Just the kind of wine that Jesus creates. And there's rich food as well that is eaten. Imagine your favourite meal, the smell, the taste. It's the kind of thing that Jamie Oliver and Heston Blumenthal would be impressed over. But actually, as I say that kind of thing, it sounds a little bit banal, doesn't it? Nice to have an extra in life. But actually, can't you get that in a good restaurant here in London if you go to the right places? Well, it's actually a picture. It is a picture of the future. And what this picture shows us is something, an offer that is out of this world, because it is a new world. Look at the quote again that I read out earlier. It's a feast where fine food is eaten, but something else is eaten as well. Death is eaten up. Death is swallowed up too. It's a feast where the wine flows, but the tears, they never flow. Sometimes, maybe, we have moments where we know we don't have real life now. We're supposed to be free to be whoever we choose, and yet we're gripped by fear and anxiety and disillusionment and dissatisfaction. Sometimes life can be very cruel, can't it? And sometimes life can bring tears. But most of all, life is very fleeting, and we know it. Some of my brother's base jumping friends, they died young. And then there's David Bowie and Alan Rickman, gone at 69 years old. And the good times are gone for good. There was a really sad story that I read in the Metro a couple of years ago about a husband and father who died of cancer, age 38. And what they did was make a cardboard cutout, a life-size cardboard cutout of him for the funeral so they wouldn't forget him. And they even took it along to a wedding. Well, maybe you know something about that kind of thing. Maybe there's that chair in the lounge and someone used to sit in it. It was their favourite chair, but they're not there now. They're not there to talk to. They're not there to laugh with. They're gone. Or maybe we watch on as someone faces serious illness and they struggle with it and we're helpless and we can't do anything about it. Or maybe it's relationships that are difficult, painful even, or superficial, or maybe we feel as if we're lacking in that department. We'd love to have a relationship that we're not in. or the struggles and the uncertainties of working life, the struggles of work, the frustrations of work. But real life with Jesus, though, real life with Jesus, no one dies and no one cries. It's a feast rather than a funeral. It's a wedding rather than a wake. It's a world with no broken homes, no broken hearts, no broken promises, no broken people, no cuts, no crises, no family rows, no upsets, no heartache, no mourning. This is out of this world, because it's nothing less than a new world, a heavenly new world. That is what this picture is all about. Heaven is not a cloud life floating somewhere. It's real life that lasts forever in a perfect new world. It is the life that we all want. C.S. Lewis famously said this: "Indeed, if we consider the unblushing promises of reward and the staggering nature of the rewards promised in the Gospels, it would seem that our Lord finds our desires not too strong, but too weak. We are half-hearted creatures, fooling about with drink and sex and ambition when infinite joy is offered us, like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in a slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by the offer of a holiday at the sea. We are far too easily pleased." Do you see what he's saying? Do you see what's on offer? This is real life. This real life, the life that we all want. And that could not be more relevant, could it? That shows us God is relevant. And it's Jesus, and it is him alone that offers us that. It is he that offers it to us. So secondly, real life Jesus, real life Jesus. I said earlier that this miracle is a sign. It points to something. But more than that, it points to someone. The Old Testament promised a feast, but this feast would also coincide with God's king arriving, coming. A new world would coincide with a new world leader. God himself, God's king, God's ruler. And it's the punchline, I think, in verse 11. So if you'd like to pick it up again, the sheet, and look down with me at verse 11, that shows us that really clearly. Let me read it for us. "This, the first of his signs, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him." Do you see what it's saying? Through this sign, Jesus reveals his glory. He shows himself to be glorious. He shows who he is. We see who the real Jesus is. It shows that he is the leader, the ruler that everybody wants. Because he alone can offer us life, real life in this perfect new world. He alone can give us the life we all want, this life free of death and pain and tears. And so that changes the way we so often view him in our culture, doesn't it? He's not a cosmic spoilsport. He's not just trying to say no or stop that. It's not about rules. He's not trying to wreck your life. He wants to give you real life. And also, Jesus, he is the ultimate bridegroom. He's the one who takes charge at this wedding when the actual bridegroom who was there isn't able to, when the wine runs out. In a sense, he takes his place. And what this shows us is a wonderful picture of the relationship that God wants with his people. It's the life we all want in the relationship that we all want, ultimately. It is the ultimate relationship. Because you see, God, he is not distant and aloof. there are no power plays. No, he's generous, he's kind, he's good. And in our culture, filled with suspicion, well, he proves here that he can be trusted. And he saves us from the alternative, which is living for self, which in the end ends up being pretty miserable as a way of living. This is the real Jesus. This is him. But there's one problem, and it's this. Why doesn't he bring all this about now? Why don't we have this new world now? Well, we get a clue, I think, in verse 4. Let me read it for us. And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." It's a little bit awkward, isn't it? Sometimes you have those awkward moments, don't you, where someone says something and you want to change the topic or talk about the weather or something like that, and people don't know where to look or what to do. Well, it feels a little bit like this as he says these words. But what is he talking about? Now, it seems, whatever way you look at it, it seems a bit abrupt. Maybe the word woman could be translated a bit more mom or something like that. But what does he mean? Well, he's saying that this is not the hour for the production of miraculous wine. This is not the hour, in a sense, because that hour is in the future. What do I mean by that? Well, let me try to explain. Jesus explains, you see, in the rest of John's Gospel, what this phrase, the hour, or this time, is. And he says, I put down the references there in case you want to look it up sometime for yourself. He says it's this. He says it is the hour of his death and his resurrection. He's saying he has to die and rise again before we can have a new world. Real life requires a death, Jesus' death. Real life, a perfect world without death, requires Jesus' death. Why is that? Well, it's because of us. It's because of our moral failure, our sin, if you like, and its consequences, death. And what that means is that in and of myself, I'm not on the guest list for this feast, this wedding banquet. I'm not ultimately on that guest list in and of myself. Now, I've been to lots of weddings. I'm sure lots of you have, and I'm looking forward to it in a couple of weeks' time to going to a wedding. But you know that moment when the invite comes through the letterbox, and normally it's on nice paper, it's, you know, nice piece of stationery. In fact, apparently you get awards for this kind of thing. The Wedding Industry Awards has an award for best stationery, and apparently the votes have closed for the 2015 awards. I haven't announced who's won yet, but there we go. You get awards for this kind of thing. But you know that moment when the invitation, it comes through your letterbox, and you open it out, and it's got this beautiful font on it, and it's this nice ink on there as it's printed, inviting you to this wedding. Well, this wedding that we see pictured here is something else. This is the ultimate wedding. And the invitation, it's not written in nice ink or just a nice font. It is written in Jesus' blood. It's written in Jesus' blood, which means that we can be invited. We can be on the guest list after all. And when he returns, it's not just Jesus that is raised to life, but we are as well. And we will be with him in this perfect world forever. Life that starts now, but continues forever. The life we all want. Real life. And that couldn't be more relevant, could it? I guess it leaves us, though, with a question. Do we know the real Jesus? Do we know him? Maybe we need to get reacquainted. Or maybe we've never been introduced. Thank you for listening. Well, maybe that's raised some questions for you. And let me suggest three ways that you might be able to follow that up. The first is, if you take this sheet again, and if you turn over the page to the back, you'll see there a box that says contact details. And the last bullet says, I'm interested in Christianity Explored. That's a course that we run from time to time, and lots of people have done it. And it's a way of really asking any question that you've got, and we try to answer it. That's the first way you might want to ask and follow up more of your questions. The second is, at the back, we've got copies of John's account of Jesus' life, which we've just been looking at. If you'd like to, feel free to pick one up from the back and read it for yourself and see what you make of it. And finally, these yellow cards advertise our next talks as we carry on in this series. Next week, we're going to be thinking about, can God allow suffering? So feel free to come along to that if you're able to. Well, that's all from me. Feel free to stay and chat. I think there might be a bit of food left if you'd like some. Otherwise, hopefully see some of you next week.